I mean, I remember I literally went and sat in my friend's office and went, how does a business work? And I remember subscribing to HR magazine and going, I need to learn a new language. And that was a very useful frame for me, was to go, okay, when you're in a foreign country, you learn the language at least a little bit and you try not to judge and you go, okay, how do these people do things here? And that's how I just looked at the business world.
Plug into the minds of the world's cutting-edge innovators, visionaries, and thought leaders who are rewriting the rules of sales and success. It's your time to make an impact. I am your host, Jason Mark Campbell, and this is the Selling with Love podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Selling with Love podcast. I have a good friend and a man that owns his own podcast, the Embodiment Podcast, sitting around 2 million downloads. The man has been the author of Embodiment, Working with the Body in Training and Coaching, has the Embodied Meditation, leads the Embodiment Conference. In essence, this man has been in this industry of personal growth for quite a while, and I'm very excited to hear about how the inner workings of his business is, what are the trends he's noticing in the industry. He has certified over 2,000 embodiment coaches, has taught workshops around 40 plus countries, and so we're going to dive deeper into the business of being into personal growth, understanding the inner workings, having an honest conversation. Had a chance to communicate with Mark Walsh, who is my guest today, during a spirituality summit. We had such a good time in that conversation. We said, hey, we should have another one when it comes to selling with love. So Mark, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here. Yeah, the last conversation was pretty wild. And it's nice to sort of go behind the scenes though and be asked about the business side, you know, having run summits and coach trainings and podcasts and all the social media, all that for a while. You know, I'm still here. That's my main claim to success. It's not that I'm a millionaire or I find it easy still, but I get to do what I love most days. And after about, it's been nearly 20 years in the industry, and again, having a podcast, I kind of get to see behind the scenes of a bunch of other people as well. So hopefully I can be of some use to listeners.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, this must be very different than your usual topics because you're really speaking about embodiment. And I do think we should at least, you know, tip the hat to the core practices you do because you teach around embodiment. You help people navigate through difficult times, you know, go on a journey for their own spiritual growth. So what got you into that topic when you decided to, you know, build your business, set up a career? This was truly the area you felt was most impactful, wasn't it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was a very cognitive kid and that didn't make me happy. Actually, it made me pretty alcoholic and suicidal. And at a certain point, I realized like, hey, there must be more to life. There must be some other ways to be smart other than cognitively. And I fell into the martial arts. And that was wonderful. And I was a live-in martial arts student for some years and really got a lot from that. Eventually, that sort of blossomed into the wider field of what I'd now call embodiment. So incorporating yoga, meditation, conscious dance, body therapy, improv, these kind of areas. But I think I pretty quickly realized like, hey, I'm not going to make a living as a martial arts teacher. That's almost impossible in the United Kingdom. It's very, very hard. You know, I knew a few people who had tried it and they'd been sort of broke their whole life and they really struggled. And at first I was despairing. I was like, well, what else is there? And then I'd done workshops in business, first of all. I thought, okay, they've got some money, so I'll do workshops in business. And then I started training other coaches, I think about 15 years ago now. And I realized I actually preferred working with coaches. I still do some work with business, but I prefer the coaches. And I basically tried to find a way to make a living from it. So I was very much an embodiment person first and a business person second. And that was a big jump for me. I remember when I said I was starting a business, my friends were like, what the hell do you know about business? You know, no one in your family is a business person. And I didn't know anything. You know, I bought my first suit, cheap suit and cheap laptop from Marks and Spencer, like a British store. And yeah, just sort of had to, I mean, I remember I literally went and sat in my friend's office and went, how does a business work? And I remember subscribing to HR magazine and going, I need to learn a new language. And that was a very useful frame for me, was to go, I'd already traveled a lot at that point. So I was like, okay, when you're in a foreign country, you learn the language at least a little bit and you try not to judge and you go, okay, how do these people do things here? And that's how I just looked at the business world. And then I came in, I had all sorts of sort of what I could call enemy images or strange preconceptions, you know, the sort of slight moral superiority that people in counterculture sometimes have. And I was dissuaded from that very quickly, both because people smelt it and didn't like it. And also because I found that it just wasn't true. I found there was, you know, just as many good people in the business world than there was in the sort of yoga world or coaching world or any other. So yeah, that's the beginning of the story.
I love it. I'm particularly happy you use the language example, because I actually speak of that a lot when it comes to people learning about sales. I'm like, you have to learn the language of sales, like, and it's not manipulation, it's empathy. It's like caring enough to learn what people need to hear for them to do decisions to help themselves. And so business in itself is even a bigger extension of that. I'd be curious, like, you had and were kind of forced into learning this business stuff. Are we at a point where, like, everyone needs to learn that stuff? Or are there still some practitioners that are like, oh no, I'm just going to stay in my lane, I don't need to know any of this business stuff?
Well, you can get a job, right? I mean, somebody else can do the business stuff for you, but then you lose a lot of, in my experience, freedom, control, creativity. And that's like, you know, I've had friends who are trainers who went to work for training companies and now they don't really have to do much business. There still may be like an internal sell to the client. Like, I was just speaking to one of my kind of few remaining corporate clients, and there's an internal sell that needs to happen, you know, so those skills are still useful. A lot of the time, though, I think it's, let's cut the crap. Let's be honest. For a lot of people, it's really a compensation. It's, I can't do something, so I'm going to say it's not worthwhile. And actually, the entrepreneurial path, maybe it's not for everyone. And I say to people like, hey, here's what it takes. You have to learn a bunch of stuff you don't want to learn. And it's not awful. You know, you can learn it like you would learn to speak French if you move to France. You know, how you can learn to drive. You know, you can learn it like a set of skills. You could even see that as a kind of tantra, as a kind of spiritual practice to learn to deal with the terror of running a business. I was just talking to a guy about some investments I have. And, you know, a lot of fear comes with that. And I'm like, do I sell now? Do I wait to the market? You know, I was looking at this. And it was like, wow, this is actually probably the biggest emotional roller coaster of my day. And how do I manage that as someone who's supposed to have some emotional intelligence, right? So I think a lot of it is a sort of overcompensation. Sort of Nietzsche actually identified this, a slave morality, he called it, where, this is not a new idea, where he said, those that can't do something say it's not worthwhile. I'm, you know, I'm paraphrasing. Actually, they would say there's a moral superiority. Like, I even hear people boast, like, oh, I'm terrible at marketing, they'll say. And I'll be like, that's not something to boast about. Right? I've become average at marketing. I'm a very average business person, but that has kept me in business to do what I love. In fact, if I was terrible, people I care about would lose their jobs and I'd have to work in the supermarket or something, God forbid. You know, I'd have to do some real hard work. One of my early jobs when I was a kid was working on farms. It was really hard, man. And I grew up in a farming area and I just went, I don't want to work out in the rain in a British November. So I think part of it is just growing up and realizing like, okay, there's a price you pay for doing what you love. And that is that you might need to learn some marketing skills. And today I was learning about Instagram reels, how to make a good hook for an Instagram reel. It wasn't so bad. Just went on YouTube, texted a couple of friends, you know, I might buy a course. You know, it's not such a big deal. Just learning a thing. It's like, it's not the end of the world. And as I said, you could even see it like a kind of tantra because you're essentially working with greed and fear the entire time.
Well, we're definitely not short of any information out there, but I definitely think we need to care enough to even go through that information. And at least when you're speaking about, well, if I learned this, there's a direct result that happens in the business, then it becomes a lot more motivating to even go and pick up these skills. And to me, it's like, man, you're hearing everything going on around, God, the latest example, and I know it's going to come left field, but there was this one actress that started selling her bathwater, and the fact that I'm mentioning it here. Yeah, I know this comes very left field, but there's an actress that started selling like bars of soap that were made with using her bathwater or something. And it got everyone talking about it. And that was the point. And it makes me realize like, God, it's just like attention is the currency. Everyone's doing anything they can to get attention. And I find it very interesting because you're in a space which is all about embodiment, which is probably about bringing back your attention. And grounding, but the industry seems to be all about taking other people's attention. And so do you find there's like marketing versus the practice and what you teach? Are they often at conflicts with each other? And is that something you have to deal with?
Yeah, they can be. And I would say this, most of my students are terrible at marketing, right? And a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago, they started asking me to teach a little bit at the end of, you know, I'd sell a coaching course. At the end, and I realized like, hey, this isn't really an integrity unless I help these people earn a living from it. So I do like a, you know, a couple of extra sessions on marketing and I actually mentor people. That's probably 50% of what I help them with is their niching and this kind of thing. That's niching if you're American. And so I realized that people needed a little help with this and it was actually really kind to help them. And the first distinction I would make, we call it Jedi versus Sith marketing, you know, like from Star Wars. It is possible to sell things by manipulating people. lying. More important than lying is bullshitting, actually. There is a technical difference between the two, between lies and bullshit. Or between, just as a Buddhist practitioner, creating aversive states. You know, am I marketing through fear? Do this or you'll die. You know, your kids will die if you don't wash everything in bleach. You'll have dandruff if you don't use this shampoo. You know, or am I marketing with greed? Am I ethical in my marketing? And most of our marketing is play. You know, there's still some classic techniques, right? It's good to have some early bird ends tomorrow kind of things, right? But we're giving people a nice long warm-up. We're actually looking for the fit. Some of the ethical marketing people I follow, like Tad Hargrave or George Cow, I'd recommend. They say, you know, looking for the fit rather than persuasion. Think of it like in terms of romance, right? Like if you meet the woman or the man of your dreams and you're really a good fit for each other, you don't have to persuade them. I don't have to hard sell my girlfriend on giving me a hug. Like, because she likes that. We both like that. It's a good fit. We both enjoy it. I mean, often the key skill sets involved in Jedi or ethical marketing would be sort of listening, creativity, and courage. I'd say those three skills. And most of my embodiment students are good at, you know, they're already pretty good at a couple of those. You know, they're often like good listeners or brave people or creative people. So often they don't have to learn as much as they think. And there is an embodied component to it, that there's a lot of sort of fear regulation. For a lot of people, this trauma stuff, you know, I'm a trauma specialist. I started a charity in Ukraine working with trauma. And for a lot of people, the act of being seen publicly is terrifying because they regard it as sort of existentially threatening on some primal, illogical, maybe childlike level. And they'll say, oh, I've got to put myself out there, which, by the way, is a horrible frame and no one should ever use. And it, of course, it creates fear for them. And they really have to work through a lot of stuff around that, or self-esteem stuff. I'm not good enough. You know, they may come with gender or class or a lot of cultural stuff. I was lucky. I had American teachers and Jewish teachers. And, you know, I sort of, you know, took some of their cultural competence, let's say, in the area. I mean that genuinely as a compliment, rather than the sort of working class British approach, which is, who do you think you are? They call it tall poppy syndrome in the Netherlands. You know, Europeans are horrible at marketing compared to people from the States in general. But then people in counterculture everywhere also struggle. Often they have a lot of images of it, like business people are bad people. I don't want to be a bad person. And actually, you know, that's fair enough, because there is a lot of unethical practices. Like most adverts on the television are bullshit. Right? They're not actually true. Like Coca-Cola is selling you freedom and friendship and world peace and none of those things. I mean, it's perfectly fine sugar water drink. I don't hate Coca-Cola, but I'm drinking, this is the Balkan equivalent called Cocta, which is a slightly healthier Balkan equivalent. So shout out to those guys. I don't hate Coca-Cola, but it's bullshit. They're not selling friendship or inspiration. You know, the adverts convey a lot of things that just aren't true. Yeah, and I think people rightly have ethical concerns, for example, about flashing their ass on Instagram, you know, selling with their sexuality. A good chunk of yoga teachers are doing some sort of weird auto-pornographic sales technique, which I just regard as unethical. And they need to be thoroughly slut-shamed immediately. You know, I'm quite conservative that way. I just don't think it's a good way to sell. So it's not something I would encourage my students to do, even if they happen to be attractive people. You know, I wouldn't suggest they hide themselves either. But if we know when someone is deliberately selling using that. We know. Ladies, you may have put the Om pendant between your breasts and leaned forward to the camera as if it was an accident, but we know. So let's cut the crap, huh?
I feel like we know most of the time. And like we have to pay attention to our own signals because they're not that hidden. Like when we see the marketing, we can smell a bit of the crap. Like we should be able to pick up on that. And I feel like we're more attuned to that. Like that's maybe one of the improvements I'm seeing, is like we seem to pick up on a lot more of the crap. You know, we're recording this, it's early June, and you've noticed all the corporates that just were all about the, you know, celebrating Pride Month. And now we're seeing none of them are, just because the climate change. And you can see they never cared to start with, you know?
I think we know as well. Like when we saw the Rainbow Barclays Bank app a couple of years ago, you know, I didn't actually genuinely think Barclays had this big commitment. I mean, it's essentially an arms race between bullshit and bullshit detectors. And you'll see this, for example, in Eastern Europe, the arms race is in a slightly different place. You know, I remember I was in Ukraine before the full-scale invasion. I was in Kiev. I saw a picture and it was a guy in a suit giving a woman an iPad and she was sort of swooning over him. It was like, women will love you if you buy them iPads, you know. And I remember thinking, God, that's a very primitive advert that you wouldn't get away with in England or America now. But, you know, because they were at an earlier stage of the sort of development of the defense mechanisms we have. And I think in our bodies, we know. like most sales techniques treat people as objects. It's objectifying. They treat people as, Kant would say, means to end rather than ends in themselves. This is Kantian definition of morality. You'll hear women rightly say, I don't want to be objectified, right? And I think we should also rightly say, then don't objectify yourself as well, right? And men don't want to be objectified. Usually with men, it's like success object. The yoga teachers could be either gender. To objectify oneself is gross. To objectify other people is gross. And what is most sales? It's seeing someone in an immoral way. I'll use the old-fashioned word, as simply a way to get money in your pocket. And you feel that, don't you? Like if you have a sales call and the guy's like, hi, Mark, it's nice to see you. And you kind of know like, ew, I can feel in my embodiment that this person isn't really empathizing. This is a fake. You know, in Eastern Europe, they're quite skeptical about the sort of American Colgate smile, you know. And it's because we know it's a manipulation. It's not really a friendly smile. It's not a genuine smile. Whereas if, you know, one of my Ukrainian friends smiles at me, it's actually because they like me and not because they want anything from me. There's cultural stuff in there too. But yeah, I think we feel how gross it is to be on the receiving end of that. And we feel the immorality of objectifying ourselves or others.
There's a couple of things I want to pull that are just fun to reference. First off, from just different advertising based on countries. I live in Indonesia, and one of my favorite ads, just because of how crazy it is that they can have an ad like that, is this guy who's like at a pool table, I think, and he's taking a shot, and there's a beautiful woman, and the slogan is like, never quit, and it's a cigarettes ad. And so, you can't get away with that in North America.
And that's just a more crude version of what people are getting away in North America every single day. I mean, what they're selling is maybe not as harmful as smoking, right? The level of obviousness may be more subtle, but it's still there. It's the guy in a white coat to persuade you that it's an authoritative figure, that this form of detergent's better than another, you know, classic Cialdini, like authority techniques or whatever, right? Like it's the same bullshit. It's just a little bit more subtle because the audience has a little got better immune system.
Okay. Well, Mark, you said something earlier that I need you to unpack. You said there's a very big difference between what is a lie and what is bullshit. I think you need to explain that.
Okay. Well, it's a technical philosophical distinction, and other people have pointed this out. There's a book, for example, called On Bullshit that people call as a philosopher's book. A lie is saying something you know is not true. So if I say, I am a dog, I know I'm not a dog, right? So that's a straight out lie. Bullshit is connecting to things that aren't connected. So when Coca-Cola, they can't outright lie on their adverts, but they can have, you know, I want to buy the world a Coke, and so the whole world is singing in harmony, and there's little black children and white children, they're playing in the water fountain or whatever. The bullshit is that this pleasantly tasting sugar water, again, I don't hate Coke, there's worse things out there, is somehow going to create world peace. That's the implicit messaging. So most of how we learn is through association. So a long time ago, advertisers, you realize they couldn't just outright lie. You know, they used to say smoking will make you more virile. It will make you more attractive. They could just outright lie, right? But then when they were stopped from outright lying, they weren't stopped from the bullshit. And we now live in a time, and America is the country with the most bullshit in the world. It always has been. I continuously feel like I'm being sold to in the United States. Again, I want to give credit where credit's due. There can be on the positive an ease with trade. I think it's in The Last Samurai, the samurai guy says, oh, it's a nation of shopkeepers. For me, there's this feeling of being sold to all the time. You know, it's like, hi, Mark, and, you know, this is my podcast. And in Europe, it's just like, oh, there has to be other values in life other than that. So yeah, the constant bullshit is now part of the global culture. Not to just pick on America, to be fair, but it's now part of global culture. Also, I feel like people are really sick of it. Like, I often get complimented on my, like, authenticity, right? But, I mean, authenticity is like wild sex. If you think you're having it, you're not, right? If someone says, I'm so authentic, it's like, you know, just the fact that you're thinking that way means you're not. The real authentic guy is not thinking he's authentic as he's being authentic, you know? Like, that's a sort of second matrix effect. But the fact that people are longing for authenticity, that was in some ways the promise of social media, right? The promise was, now you're talking to a real human being, right? And actually then that becomes another layer of bullshit. But there's certainly some possibility that it's harder for brands to lie now, you know, because you can say, here's the Barclays app in California. Here's the Barclays app in Dubai. Oh, look how different they are. Right? People, there's an accountability there now. There's a transparency that there maybe wasn't 30 years ago.
So if I take this and I start applying that to the space for a lot of people that are into coaching, I find that the one, and God, like I've tried to create some trainings and helping people how to sell more as coaches, but the dream in the coaching world is like, hey, quit the 9 to 5, become a coach, make a ton of money. That's not always what happens. And so what are we seeing in the coaching space that people need to pay attention to so that they can have a good radar for the bullshit, but they can find themselves be successful in this career?
Here's how you are successful long term: is you get really, really good at what you do and you do it consistently. Okay. So my specialism is working with the body and training and coaching. I wrote the book on it. I've done the podcast and I've done it for years. I don't have to inflate myself when I talk about that or get depressed and sad or kind of smallify myself just because I've done it so much that I know it works. It's like if I brush my teeth get clean. If I work out, my biceps get bigger or whatever. It's just a very obvious connection to me. So I can have a confidence in that, which sells itself. Also, I have a lot of referrals. You know, 50% of our clients at least come through referrals because I've been around for a while. I get invited to do speaker gigs, like coaching groups, ICF groups around the world. I do at least 10 a year, different ICF groups. I get invited places, as Prague this weekend, because I have, I'd say, one, the niching idea. People should definitely check out Tad Hargrave on Marketing for Hippies on niching. I think once you're known for a particular thing, and you can't get known for everything, right? Like even with a team behind me, having second, third products that we have, like, yeah, I might be known for trauma work in Ukraine, but I'm not primarily known for that in the coaching world. So having a good niche, being consistent, I say to people like, look, are you prepared to be self-exploited rather than employed? Are you prepared to work for 2 or 3 years really, really hard? And then you get a coin flip for success. Because if you're not, stay in your job. Like with my mentees, I'll say, look, I can teach you some good coaching skills in 6 months. But if you really want to make a living from this, you're going to have to go through a niching process, which may take 1 to 2 years, usually two. You're going to have to learn a whole bunch of skills that are really uncomfortable. And you're going to work harder than most people. And this idea that you can be, you know, sort of a mom and working 20 hours a week and also a spiritual goddess and you're on the beach and... I mean, maybe like I could probably cruise now after 20 years of doing this stuff, right? Because I've got books out, I've got podcasts out, I've got all this stuff out. But certainly for the first few years of employment, expect to work till your eyes bleed and you still might not be successful. Just, I'd say a coin flips chance if you're a smart guy, smart man or woman, right? Like coin for a 50-50 chance. So like, unless you're prepared to, I say to my mentees, I say, look, you know, you're going to work really, really hard to maybe have success, and it's going to take a few years. Are you okay with that? Because if you think you're going to do this overnight, forget it.
Well, this sounds like any company you want to start. Like this is like, I went to business school. You get into the entrepreneurship class, it's the same thing. It's like, don't expect to make money in the first 2 years. So like, there's nothing crazy about it, but I definitely know that, you know, as marketers, we've advertised heavily, made promises that are a little too bold. And that's kind of skewed the expectations. And so now it seems like there's a lot of people that have jumped into the market. And I'd just be curious, like, are we seeing at least a trend if the market is growing or shrinking? Because that usually is the best thing that could entice you to want to become a coach, is to even know if the opportunity is getting bigger or smaller.
Yeah. I mean, coaching's getting better known. So that's a cool thing. I think the big threat to the coaching world is AI. So I know any day now I'm going to see a therapy app, and if they can do it with therapy, they can do it with coaching. In fact, most of the therapy apps legally call themselves coaching apps. I'm going to see a therapy app that actually works, and it won't be as good as a real therapist, but you know, like this t-shirt isn't as good as a hand-sewn one from an Italian tailor, right? But it's one-tenth the price, right? So any day now, I'm going to see a really good, or at least a semi-good, and semi-good means it's good enough to be scaled and it's super cheap, therapy app. And the moment we see a therapy app, all the coaches who are working just with clever questions are now out of business. I mean, you can train ChatGPT to be a pretty good coach already. It can ask you some clever questions. Now, if you want an AI that picks up on your body language and, you know, can look at your movements and eye contact, and you know that's possible too within a few years, very likely. You know, we'll be set up with a camera and it'll be trained on 1,000 subjects, so we'll immediately have 1,000 hours of experience, right? And again, I'd say if you're not doing anything with touch, with consciousness, with embodiment, but not just embodiment, there's a few areas that have some immunity, not just mine. If you're not doing something with one of the areas that's a little bit more than the cognitive, let's say, there are spiritual coaching schools, for example, as well, that have some immunity, and then you're going to be replaced because you're going to be a lot more expensive than the AI. And if you look at history, people always say, we won't be replaced. You know, the samurai said, we won't be replaced by the gun. And they were, right? It's not that they didn't have some cool skills. The samurai had some amazing skills. But compared to the scalability of firearms, they were out of business. So yeah, that's what I'd say is the major threat to the coaching world. But, you know, we're also seeing increased institutional adoption, like the company I spoke to today. Coaching's very normal in that world. So I'd say that's a key challenge.
You already hinted towards this advantage, or at least this resistance to being made obsolete when it comes to embodiment type of work. And obviously that's what you teach. But, you know, working with somebody, whether that's with touch, whether that's anything, that seems to be one of the things people should consider to maybe stay more relevant for longer, and at least as a practice that still requires a human touch.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's good to be diversified for your survivability. So you want to be niched so you get really, really good at one thing, but then you also want to have your fingers in a few pies, right? Like doing a few different things. Like I have my trauma work, I do live workshops, I do corporate work. It may be that we just go very high end, you know, in the same way as you have machine suits, like the cheap one I bought from Marks and Spencer, and you have the handmade Italian tailors who have been going for 10 generations. They still exist. They're just high end. So it's a different section of the market. It may be that there's a particular market segment, like in the same way as you have organic food. It may be that you have sort of organic coaching, you know, for those who don't want the AI. I think it's actually fascinating that it's going to... One really cool thing AI is doing is highlighting how we're not machines, because the sort of computer metaphor of the human brain is a metaphor. It's not even that good a metaphor. With the brain isn't a computer. It's something completely different. It's going to highlight what do we have that's a bit special. You'll see this with writing. You know, I just wrote a book for young men on mental health and life purpose. Again, diversify. And my editor used a bunch of AI on it, and it was disgusting. It was gross. I had to take out 90% of it. I said, don't ever do that again when you're editing one of my books, because I could taste the cling film on it. And even though it was clever AI and it was smart, it just wasn't quite. It's like the same with AI art. It's not quite there. So I think there's a humanness. But again, let's not overstate that, because a generation will come up who have had AI girlfriends and AI existence. Like one of my employees sent me an AI message for the first time the other day, and I kind of just about spotted it, you know? And it's like, I think this is going to be an increasingly common thing for people to do. So as people get used to that, the AI coach will seem less and less weird.
I was having somebody on the show as a copywriter, and we were having this exact discussion about how, like, it's pretty close. It's probably going to get there, but it's still not quite there. But it's fascinating how it's shaping things. And, well, on the subject of you running your businesses, obviously AI has been a powerful tool. Where are the places you find yourself using it the most, and that's provided you some massive leaps in the way that you operate?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't done anything massive with it yet. The embodiment world is really slow adopters, so we can be semi-slow adopters. It's like we were doing summits, and we're considered innovative in the summit world. We, you know, we did the biggest summit there's ever been, as far as I can tell, you know, 1,000 speakers, 500,000 delegates. But we were late adopting that more. Yeah, no one else. It's just an insane proposition. It was all live as well. 1,000 live sessions.
Wait, and were you hosting all of that?
Yeah,
you
had
multiple hosts.
Well, there was 10 channels. I was hosting the sort of main stage, as it were. So yeah, 10 days, 10 channels, 1,000 teachers live. So, you know, that's insane. But we actually adopted
that. You're making me feel very lazy for my summit.
Oh, don't do what we did. I wouldn't recommend it. No, 30 is a good number. You're sensible. You're smart. We were late adopters, but, you know, my industry tends to be late. So with AI, we've done a few things. We use it a little bit in copywriting, but we always have a human check. Just saves a bit of time. I use it as a teacher. So I was teaching boundaries last week, right? I was teaching a summit on boundaries. And what I did is I just said, okay, here's what I think about boundaries. Fed some stuff into it. I wrote a book on people pleasing. So it's like I have good topic knowledge. And I said, what am I missing? And I didn't expect much, but you know, it gave me a couple of extra points. You know, I was like, oh shit, I've forgotten that. Oh yeah, I used to teach that, but it's been a while. Or, you know, so I think as a teacher, as a podcaster, like if you were on as my guest, I would totally, you know, ask ChatGPT. I'd say, who's this guy that's coming on? Let's check him out. Dig up some dirt on you, Jason, you know, about that
Absolutely.
Donkey in Azerbaijan. So, you know, like I use it for a little bit of guest research. I think my team use it on their email marketing. We have a pretty sophisticated email platform. I employ someone 20 hours a week just to look after my email list. And definitely building a list is another thing we should talk about. I would swap all my social media for my list. Like if someone said choose between all your social media and your list, I'd choose my list, like 100% of the time. I mean, there's so many topics we could go into.
You go deep on that because most people don't think the list is dead, email is dead, and it's never been.
Well, it's reliable, right? There's a few things, you know, like I know if I email people, like we get like a 30% open rate, which is pretty good for the industry. And I'm not getting 30%. I think I've got like 75K on Instagram right now, my main account. I don't get a 30% open rate there. It's not like every reel has 25K. That's not the case at all, right? So also I can control it a lot more. Like I can just be banned from any one of those, you know, given my personality and outspoken views. I mean, I'm borderline illegal in the UK, right? So, you know, just for having some of the views I have. So, you know, I could be banned from any of those platforms. An email provider can ban you, but it's a lot harder to do and you still have the list. So we could migrate that list over to another email provider. It's a hassle if they did that. We had one that shut us down briefly. So then we found one that was a bit less woke afterwards. You still have to be a little bit careful, but it's not nearly as big a risk. Also, people take it more seriously, right? Like if I emailed you something, it's very different than if I Facebook messaged you something, right? So you see a reel. I think socials are really great for building relationship and not necessarily great for sales. So a lot of our coaching customers, for example, they need 6 months to a year on our email list plus one of our social platforms. So I have a team, so I'm able to run Facebook, YouTube, a podcast, and Instagram. I wouldn't recommend that. If anyone's listening to this who's solo, just get good at one of those things. You know, like Chris Williamson and I started podcasts at the same time, but he was just doing that. So he's way better than me. And I don't mind saying that. He's just way better than me because he focused on that. And I've been focused on a million other things. So I'd say for most people, do what Chris did, which is just focusing on one thing rather than 10 things. But now it's quite good for us in that most people do one of those four things. Not everyone has Instagram, but, you know, obviously it depends on your target demographic. If your target demographic is all like 15-year-old kids, then, you know, your TikTok is fine. You don't need a Facebook because that's their mom's social media, right? So people always tell you, oh, you have to have an Instagram. It's like, no, you don't. Not if your audience isn't there. Not if you hate it. Like, don't do any social media you hate. Like, personally, I like doing podcasts. You know, I'm Irish. I can talk shit all day. It's no problem. You know, like, I like interviewing people. I learn stuff. You know, I like doing little reels. I just have a laugh on my Instagram. Just, you know, I make funny reels and just send it to my team to post. But, you know, other stuff, like, I'm off Facebook personally generally now because it's just toxic now. It's just unpleasant. So there is a sort of emotional cost-benefit analysis to the marketing you do. And I would say, like, email's pretty low on that front. It's pretty clean. It's pretty straightforward, data-driven. And you could really get into it. Like, we don't send one email. We send, you know, I guess like other people, you work with Mindvalley, right? I'm sure they do the same. They have a sophisticated team who are sending 17 versions of the same email. Well, you know, if you're a beginner, you can still like A-B test stuff. You don't have to be that sophisticated, but you can still go, well, that's, we test 5 subject lines every time we send an email, right? So it's like this, I like data-driven marketing. I'm like, I just fired someone in my social media team because he just wasn't getting a result. And he's like, yeah, but I'm really good. And I was like, okay, well, show me the numbers. Right. And we had this conversation before and he was given fair warning. But ultimately, it was like, look, I run a small company. Ethically, if everyone isn't doing their job well, no one's rent gets paid. You know, there's a Hungarian single mom in my team whose child eats because she gets paid. Right. So it's like there's an ethical responsibility to actually marketing well. People think that like marketing is somehow like evil, but I'd say this, it's like, if what you're doing is good, you have an ethical responsibility to get it to people. Also, it's a form of self-care. So for me, like actually like learning a little bit of sales and marketing is like, people talk about bubble baths and massages. It's like, that shit doesn't matter if you're broke. A, because you can't afford the massage, but B, you know, your massage might be 1 hour a week. Being broke is the whole week. And, you know, you can be enlightened and be happy when you're broke. Sure, there's happy poor people. I've met them. But it's a hell of a lot easier if those sort of hierarchy of needs is a little bit taken care of, right? You know, if you want to eat well, that costs money. So it's, you know, self-care. I say it rests on finances and boundaries. They're the two things it really rests on.
Mark, this is exactly the kind of conversation I want to have with you, giving us a little peek behind the curtain and just having a genuine good conversation on the state of sales, marketing, and the business itself of coaching and coaching coaches and embodiment. And so one thing I wanted to make sure I ask you, which you kind of started answering right there, and I'm going to poke at you a bit more. You're on the Selling with Love podcast. What does selling with love mean to you?
Yeah. So first of all, it means selling ethically. And ethical is defined by not liars, not bullshitting, and also not creating what the Buddhists would call aversive states. That's the basic level. So not selling with hate would be the first level, right? Like I'm not creating anger, fear, blah, blah, blah. Secondly, it means you're looking for the fit rather than using someone as an object to get what you want. I like the analogy. It's like the romance of the customer. You know, you meet on some social media platform, you swap details, maybe you have some small coffee, later you have drinks. I don't know why I'm French for this purpose, but there's a relationship that's built human to human. For me, that's relational marketing would be another way of saying it. And I'm treating that person as a human being. That is the key thing there. Last one, actually, I'd say sell from your fucking heart. Like, I never want to be in the position of selling something I hate. I know my courses are good because people have gone through them and told me that, and I've seen the result over the years, right? This is why it's harder when you begin, right? Because you don't actually know that you're not selling crap or not. Once you've been around for a while, you're like, I can see it's getting good stuff for people, you know? Like if I had a sandwich and you were hungry, would it not be more loving to tell you I had a sandwich? So what is marketing? It's just telling people you have a fucking sandwich. That's all it is. It's like, I have a sandwich. Are you hungry? Do you like sandwiches? This one's got sausage, whatever in, you know? And this sandwich isn't for everyone because I like the white bread, not that dirty black German bread. I hate that. You know, that nasty bread, your German bread that's too thick. I don't want that kind of sandwich. It's fluffy white bread with bacon and eggs and ketchup. And if you don't like that kind of sandwich, I don't hate you. That's okay. You don't have to eat this sandwich. There's plenty of other sandwiches out there. Yeah? So telling people you have food when they're hungry is love. So not marketing is evil. Marketing is love.
Mark, it was an absolute joy having a conversation with you. Thank you for coming on the show and sharing the wisdom, sharing the sandwiches analogies as well. That's the first one and I love it.
That's right. We got sandwiches analogies, we've got romance analogies. There's the just learn the life skills analogy. There's the tantra analogy. There's four or five analogies people need. I say to my students, just pick one. Pick one of those that works. So, Jason, always a pleasure, man. Really nice to see you. I wish you all success with this.
Hey, man, yourself as well. And for everybody tuning in, if you want to go deeper into the Embodiment podcast, we'll put a link to that as well as more of Mark's work. He has his book, Embodiment. And if you are a coach and you're trying to learn a new practice and have some of those marketing and sales skills and you resonate with this message, make sure you check out more of Mark Walsh's work. This was a fantastic conversation. Thank you for coming on the show. And until next time, keep selling with love.
Cheers.
I am your host, Jason Mark Campbell, and this is the Selling with Love podcast.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.